This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Right, I like it. The reign of BlackRock is coming to an end, at least in the $7.8 trillion market for U.S. exchange-traded funds, also known as ETFs, which BlackRock has just dominated for decades. I know somebody who knows quite a bit about ETFs. That's none other than Bloomberg News senior markets reporter and BTV anchor Katie Greifeld. She writes all about Vanguard's rise for Bloomberg Business Week. It hits newsstands later this week, but you can read her story now on the Bloomberg Terminal and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Also here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio, we got the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber. Joel, this was bound to happen at some point.
It hasn't happened yet. Katie and I talk a lot about ETFs. I think from the get-go, we'll just say, Larry Fink, if you're listening, you can reach Tim Stenovic at TSTNOVEC1 at Bloomberg.net.
That's right.
This is not happening yet.
I'm available.
But if you look at the trend line of how Vanguard has slowly risen and how BlackRock has slowly fallen, there will be an inflection moment not too far away, right, Katie? We don't know when. It will probably happen.
Probably in the next 18 to 24 months. There are some nuances there, which I'm sure we'll get into. But I mean, like Joel said, this is something that the industry has been watching and waiting for probably a decade at this point. If you take a look at the chart of market share.
It's a lot of popcorn.
A lot of popcorn.
Worth of popcorn.
Yeah, we've been waiting for this one. But Vanguard has been increasing its share of the U.S. ETF market for 21 straight years. Just amazing growth coming out of Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. And BlackRock...
Sleepy there.
Sleepy, yeah. A lot of trees. But BlackRock, I mean, BlackRock is still enormous. Let's just put that out there. $2.5 trillion in U.S. ETF assets. But their share has been dropping and dropping. Right now, it's at the lowest in at least 20 years, 32.5%. Vanguard at 29.5%. That is the slimmest margin between these two ever.
What's up with that?
So there's a few things going on right now. Vanguard enjoys a very, very loyal investor base. You think about who they appeal to. It's financial advisors, it's retail investors, not YOLO retail investors, but actual mom and pop. And
Boglehead.
Yes, exactly. And those are very sticky assets. And that type of investor base, it tends to shovel in money to these funds in almost every market cycle.
Actually, when things get worse,
yes,
they pile in.
Exactly.
It's like, oh, great, buying opportunity, we're in.
Exactly. So that's what they're enjoying. They have a very loyal, sticky asset base. Whereas you think about these BlackRock funds, they're enormous, they're very liquid, and they're trading tools. I mean, right. Wall Street uses these, and Wall Street, those flows are more volatile.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, Katie. I too hail from not far from Valley Forge. I'm sleepy myself, I can relate. Always been fascinated with Vanguard. Because the other reason is I'm notoriously a cheapskate. You know, I do not want to spend more on something.
Vibe. All right.
Yeah. You can tell. But so I look at, okay, the flagship ETFs of both companies, you know, and Vanguard, you know, 0.3% on the S&P 500, its expense ratio.
0.03, right?
Zero, 0.03%.
Yeah.
So 3 basis points.
Three basis points for those following at home that speak on Wall Street language. So to me, it's amazing this hasn't. Why has it taken so long? Like, what makes the BlackRock funds competitive at a higher management fee than Vanguard?
Well, the thing is, I will say that BlackRock has been forced to sort of follow Vanguard's lead here. Yeah. They've had to cut fees as well, introduce their own very low-fee products. You take a look at their S&P 500 funds, the iShares one, ticker IVV, That also charges 3 basis points to match Vanguard's fee. But in terms of why, I mean, BlackRock has enjoyed this position at the top of the league table for so long, since 2006, they were an early mover here, and that's really powerful in the ETF market. That first-to-market advantage, you see it both on the issuer side and also when new product sets are introduced, when a new category is introduced. So that is in BlackRock's favor. Also, you think about some of their funds. I mean, TLT, that is their long-dated treasury ETF.
God, you love TLT. You love talking about TLT.
Well, I'm talking about TLT so much because it has been insane. The volume in the fund this year has been incredible. People are shoveling so much money into this ETF this year, even though it's
this year's meme stock is TLT?
Kind of. It kind of is. Like these funds that...
The normie meme stock.
These funds that BlackRock have, a lot of them are just capital market instruments, and that's really powerful. That's why SPY, which charges 9 basis points, which is the S&P 500 tracking fund introduced by State Street. It's the oldest, it's the biggest, it's relatively expensive, but it's just been around for so long. That's what people use.
Yeah, still bigger than Vanguard's fund at more than 3 times the, granted, both are pretty cheap to...
In the grand scheme of life, but I mean, this is a market that's measured in basis points, so it's pretty expensive.
Yeah. You know, one thing that BlackRock has that Vanguard does not have...
Tell me.
...is a filing for a Bitcoin ETF.
I was wondering when we would get there.
Well, we're here now. Everyone's favorite thing to talk about in the ETF world.
It's at least 50% of people's favorite thing to talk about in the ETF world who are in this room.
So if you haven't been following closely, there is no spot Bitcoin ETF, but there's something like, what, 13 filings?
Something like that.
Something, I lost track. Vanguard is not one of them.
No.
So what's going to happen if BlackRock has a moment here where they get to have a Bitcoin ETF and Vanguard doesn't have one?
This is so fun. I'm so glad we're talking about this because it sort of gets into the spiritual differences between BlackRock and Vanguard. BlackRock has over 400 ETFs. That is a lot of ETFs.
Wow.
They're in virtually every single asset class.
More than anybody else.
Pretty much. You take a look at Vanguard, even though there's only $200-300 billion that separates them in AUM, Vanguard only has 83 funds. Vanguard is not, they don't even have a commodities ETF. So they're very plain vanilla.
And by plain vanilla, it's like hold the vanilla bean, just like straight vanilla.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I asked Vanguard, will you ever file for a spot Bitcoin ETF? And usually it's hard to get Vanguard to say anything too fired up. They said, absolutely, we have no intent to do this. The case for cryptocurrency is very weak, high volatility, et cetera. Whereas BlackRock, they are leading the charge here. A lot of people watching January to see if that spot Bitcoin ETF gets approved. And if it does, that can give them a leg up, especially if BlackRock puts their spot Bitcoin ETF into some of their model portfolios. That could be a game changer here and buy them a little bit of time.
Except when Joel used to send me down to Vanguard to interview Jack Bogle.
It's true.
Probably 10 years ago at this point.
Yeah.
Talk about, he was happy to shake things up. He would spitfire.
He'd have a few things to say about a Bitcoin ETF. Intent was like the G version of what you'd get from Jack Bogle.
Right, exactly. But, you know, Bogle never wanted to have an ETF in the first place. You know, you'd ask him about ETFs, and the argument was, well, you can trade it all day. And he'd be like, why the heck would you want to do that?
Yeah, exactly.
So I wonder, is it sort of the ghost of Bogle that's influencing Vanguard, or is it more to do with just the structure? You know, BlackRock is a for-profit company. It has its own stock. It has its own shareholders to answer to. Vanguard's a completely different business model. So why don't you talk to us about that, and does that play a role in their decisions on things like this?
I think it is partly the Bogle effect here, to name check a book by
Eric
Balchunas.
I've read a book called that before.
Yeah, Joel, I don't know if you know him.
I do. We co-host a podcast together called Giants.
He's actually not, he's not quoted in this story, though.
Eric Balchunas?
No.
I mean, that would be too on the nose. I can do that. But yeah, I mean, you think about, again, Bogle's choice words. He, to your point, Vanguard doesn't say anything too, it's hard to rile them up. Bogle definitely was more outspoken. But yeah, he didn't have a lot of love for commodities. It makes sense that Vanguard doesn't have a lot of love for crypto. Again, to go back to the quote that they gave me, they say that most crypto assets, They lack intrinsic economic value. They generate no cash flows. That is a biggie for Vanguard. It's the same thing with commodities not generating any cash flows. Just, it's totally out of their profile that they would even venture into crypto.
It seems like BlackRock might be worried about this. Like, you've seen this lead continue to sort of slip away. It goes back to, obviously, BlackRock acquired iShares, and that was like this amazing acquisition.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get a sense that BlackRock's nervous about this, about the moment that they become sort of like the number two in the ETF game?
I will say that BlackRock is pretty competitive in spirit.
Yeah.
And I think it's also to point out here, even though their share is slipping, it's a case of the pie is just getting bigger.
The pie is getting much bigger, right?
Much, yeah. Much bigger.
Hence the podcast name, Trillions.
Yeah.
Trillions.
Yeah.
It grows a lot.
Yeah, we're up to $7.8 trillion in U.S. ETF assets, about $10 trillion globally. You take a look at BlackRock's U.S. ETF assets, they're at $2.5 trillion. That's an all-time high. So it's not like BlackRock is shrinking here. It's just that you have this very formidable challenger in Vanguard, and also you have all of the others. I mean, you take a look at the percent of flows that are going to people outside of BlackRock, outside of Vanguard, and it's at a record high.
Hmm. So it's not just that people want the boring stuff that, you know, boring low fee stuff that Vanguard has. So Joel asked about the competitiveness of BlackRock, and if they're watching this closely, what about Vanguard? Do they care if
no.
they're number one?
No. That I mean, again, I always, as someone who's been covering this for a few years, I just love the spiritual differences between BlackRock and Vanguard. Where BlackRock is competitive and, you know, wants to be number one, Vanguard does not care. The exact quote that I got from them is, "Vanguard isn't focused on who's at top of the ETF league tables." And I believe them, so it's pretty interesting.
They're like, league what?
You watch that
thing? You just come to us. I also, you know, the spiritual difference there is, like, you know, the financial advisor, I think, is a set that really gravitates to Vanguard, whereas like more of like a, probably like the trader is who I think you said earlier, Katie,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's something that I make sure to put in every story because it's very real. I mean, even though their share is going down, their importance among Wall Street traders is only going up. A lot of people are using these as liquidity sleeves, et cetera, a way to get quick exposure, these BlackRock products, because a lot of them just trade like water.
Well,
okay.
Go ahead.
No.
Well, I was going to ask Katie, you know, there's also, I mean, typically, traditionally, when you hear ETF, you think of a passive index tracking product until names like Cathie Wood come up and others who are actually running actively managed ETFs.
Which has been a theme this year. Like,
yeah.
Active management has had, that has been one of the big takeaways of the year.
Yeah, yeah. So where do we stand with that? Are both of these companies losing share to providers that have more active ETFs?
That's where the others come in. Again, yeah. You take a look at the percent of share of flows that are going to outside of the big two, and a lot of that is going to these actively managed ETFs. And I got to say, it's really interesting. Even though BlackRock likes to be number one in most things, they aren't a really huge player in the active ETF space. You take a look at their lineup again, they have over 400 US ETFs. Only 38 of them are actively managed. And they have launched a few. Rick Rieder, for example, their big fixed income guy, I forget his exact title, but he's very important. He launched his first ETF this year. So they're bringing out some of their star players in the ETF wrapper as an active strategy. But again, these issuers, they're not known for being active managers, even though they are so huge.
What do you think that would be inside the Tim Sinovic wrapper?
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I would love to know.
You have a full minute to think about it, Katie.
I feel like you would be extremely sensible, and then there would be like 1% to 5% of your portfolio that would be absolutely bananas.
Is that the Eric Balchunas calls that the hot sauce, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's like exactly. In the burrito, you just put a little bit of hot sauce. Yours would have, you know, maybe a little bit more than usual.
Oh, I would love a burrito right now. Why did you bring that up? It sounds great.
All right.
Should we?
It's a great
burritos?
To end on.
Should we do it? Burritos?
I mean, you know, Taco Bell's around the corner.
Yeah.
Right? Also, Chipotle.
This is a good piece, Katie. I didn't know we could actually talk for 14 minutes about Vanguard and BlackRock ETFs. But then I saw you come
started.
In the studio, and then I knew we could actually.
I was going to ask Katie to name all 400 BlackRock ETFs. Go.
At this point, I could probably get at least 100 of them.
Hey, check out this story. It's in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. It's available on newsstands, online, and on the the Bloomberg Terminal later this week. But right now you can read the story on the Bloomberg Terminal and, of course, at Bloomberg.com. It's about the $7.8 trillion market for U.S. traded ETFs, which BlackRock has dominated for decades. A big thank you to Bloomberg News senior markets reporter and BTV anchor Katie Greifeld, who writes all about it in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week. Also, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber. Everyone here at a nice little roundtable in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studios. You're watching and listening to Bloomberg Business Week.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, maybe if you've been traveling internationally, you've seen these ads in airports, or maybe in some international cities you've been going around in. The campaign features some of the most well-known French athletes, chefs, scientists, designers, and more. They chose France, and they're telling you to do the same. It's all part of an international marketing effort aimed at attracting interest in and investment to France, of course, the seventh largest economy in the world, and one that right now is trying to distinguish itself from its European peers. Olivier Becht is the Minister Delegate for Foreign Trade, Economic Attractiveness, and French Nationals Abroad. It's quite the title you have there, and that's not even your full title, I should say. He joins us here in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio. Olivier, how are you?
Yeah, fine. Good afternoon, everybody.
Yeah, it's good to have you with us. Why is now the right time to launch France. This such a launch such a big campaign internationally?
Well, first of all, because we had a very pro-business agenda with President Macron governments since 6 years. And then we are the most attractive country in Europe for foreign investments for 4 years in a row. And I think it's a particularly good time just after the World Rugby Cup and just before the Olympics next year in Paris. To make this national branding campaign for choosing France and say it to all investors around the world that they are pretty really welcomed here in France. I think it's time to face tremendous challenges in IT, in space, in health, and France is a very good place to do it.
You know, Olivier, when you talk about attracting investment capital and businesses to France, sort of prioritize for us, what's at the top of that list? What would you really love to see come into France as far as investment flows?
Well, we don't have really priorities. I think we have a France 2030 investment plan for innovation. Mm-hmm. The first priority in this plan is to decarbonize industry. Yeah. But we also have priorities in artificial intelligence, in quantum, in biotechs, to invent together 20 new biomedicines to 2030, yeah. And 10 to 2025. We already have four. We wanted to invest also in new energies, like solar panels, like wind farms, like hydrogen. And we wanted to use the new energies in mobilities to invent together the new plane. Maybe tomorrow, hydrogen plane, electric plane, or with other propulsions, sustainable aviation fuel. So I think there is a lot of money in this plan to help businesses to invest in. And we will be very happy if new American companies will be part of this venture.
What would you say to somebody who says, you know, it would be great for us to be investors in France, but we're intimidated by the regulatory environment, not just by the regulatory environment of the EU, but also of the French government. And then also, let's be frank, the labor laws in the country.
I will tell this person that they missed something during the last year. We really transformed France. We reduced the tax burden. For instance, for corporate taxes, it was 33.5%. It's now 25%. We cut 10, maybe 15 now billion euro on tax production. We reform the labor law. It's more flexible now. It's very secured, especially for job. And I think we also reduce all the complexity. We simplify the administrative procedures. We have key turn sites to implant a factory in 9 months now in France. So I think that France in 2015, it's not France in 2023. So it's really time for choosing France.
Well, and 2023, kind of a strange year. I mean, I feel like we've had a few very strange years when it comes to global trade, geopolitics. I mean, starting with, you know, the trade wars with the U.S. and China under the Trump administration, then the invasion of Ukraine, now Israel. And I think, you know, from where we're sitting, I think the assumption is that all of this has perhaps brought the U.S. and Europe and France closer together, tightened their bonds. But I'm curious how you see it. How does France and trade and investment in France fit into this really dramatic shift in geopolitics that we've seen over the last few years? Are there opportunities, more problems than opportunities? And, you know, how do you navigate all of these shifting
I think you're right. We are living in a time of shocks, sanitary shocks with COVID-19, then the invasion war in Ukraine from Russia, now in the Middle East, and also climate shocks and maybe technology shocks. But in this time of shocks, I think it's good first to restore the multilateralism, and I think we have a real issue next February in the MC13 in Abu Dhabi for the WTO. We should restore the dispute settlement mechanism. It was one of the topics I spoke about with American officials yesterday in Washington. We have also to reinforce the links between France and United States, Europe and United States. We should now have permanent agreement on our dispute on sustainable steel and aluminium with Airbus, Boeing also. I think we really have to change our trade. We need more sustainable trade with new standards, and I think WTO is a good place to do it. But we must also reinforce the links between United States and Europe, because it's not only trade; it's friend sharing, it's also near sharing. It's a place where we can bide together value chain in the field we need for energy transition, for instance.
After all, the U.S. and France are very close allies. Hey, just in the last minute that we have with you, I want to talk politics a little bit. You're here in the U.S. We're about to be in a presidential election year.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Next year?
Yeah, next year. Yeah.
You haven't heard about that, huh?
Yeah, I heard about it.
How are you and your government watching what happens here next year? A potential Trump 2.0.
Well, so you're right. France and United States, we are oldest ally. We are friend. You know, I'm coming from Alsace region on the border, East France on the border, and Germany and Switzerland. And I personally know what we own to United States, just our liberty. Yeah. My grandparents were lived two world wars. So we really have this link, and we don't forget, of course, that Lafayette and the French troops participate to the War of Independence in Chesapeake or in Yorktown. So I would say that, of course, we are really working well today with Biden administration. But we respect, as a foreign government, we respect the democratic decision of the American people. And we will work, right, of course, with all the American governments. We just hope that we will remain open. Isolation is not for us a solution today to
Mr.
face
Minister,
the challenges.
We're going to have to leave it there. Really appreciate you joining us. Olivier Becht, Minister Delegate for Foreign Trade, Economic Attractiveness, and French Nationals Abroad.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Bitcoin has been on a tear this year, Mike Regan.
It really has.
It's not NVIDIA or Meta platforms, but it's still up close to 140% so far this year. And you're the crypto guy now. What's going on?
Well, and it's funny because we talked about everything else moving after the Fed, but look at Bitcoin today, up another 4%, knocking on the door of $43,000 a token again. And
I'm sorry, is it 2021?
It's starting to feel a little bit like it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the main thing is, you know, anticipation of these ETFs being approved. There's other more technical things, the halving next year, and really the prospects for lower interest rates, more liquidity from the Fed, I think, is helping too. But don't take it from me, because we've got a much better expert on this topic to walk us through everything going on in the crypto market. His name is Jason Urban. He is the global head of trading at Galaxy Digital. He's joining us over Zoom from New York City. Jason, thank you for joining the show.
Thanks for having me. This is great, and I'm glad I could be here on a day when it's good news and not bad news.
And well, Jason, you know, we mentioned that ETF, and I think, you know, it's pretty much the consensus that optimism about finally, what's it been, over a decade since the first application for a Bitcoin ETF. We're finally potentially near the finish line where the SEC might actually approve one. But I think a lot of question on people's minds is, you know, is that a sell the news event? Is all the hype before the ETF is actually launched? Or will we continue to see a bull market in Bitcoin once we do get an ETF?
I think it's going to continue to be a bull market, and it's structural. At the end of the day, if you think about the crypto ecosystem, one of the things that we've been missing for a long time is a steady supply of assets, an actual pathway for money to get in. And you can see that in how the basis trades, especially when the markets are going higher. That just means that there's less dollars in the ecosystem. With an ETF, you're going to release that because people are going to be able to pledge it as margin. They're going to be able to buy it on margin. And so that is going to push it higher. It actually unleashes a lot of the value that has been very difficult. And I think we saw some of the darker days of crypto in 22, when a lot of these lenders who had extended leverage in an irresponsible way, but that leverage was what was fueling it. I know we kind of, you joked on the onset that 21 was, is this 2021 again? Well, the ETF is going to do that, but it's going to be able to happen in a more responsible, appropriate way, and that's what's going to pull it up. I mean, we're here at Galaxy on the trade desk, we're seeing real buyers come in, people who are not fast money, but who are buy and hold, who are believing in it, and they're not, you know, the usual people that you would normally see. And quite frankly, it's really encouraging, because when I come on the desk and they say XYZ just bought, I'm like, really? We've been talking to them for 2 years. And finally, you know, they've decided to pull the trigger. And so I think the ETF only one, makes them more comfortable, and then two, structurally allows more money to flow into the ecosystem. Oh. So I think it really is a big positive.
Oh, Jason, if only you could tell me who XYZ is. I have a feeling you won't, but
although XYZ wouldn't be a client anymore if I could.
Exactly. But, you know, Jason, I obviously, if we do think back to 2021,
It was such a different market then, in that we weren't just talking about Bitcoin. We were talking about, you know, Dogecoin and all these other fringe tokens, altcoins. But really, the other big story then was this lending, crypto borrow and lending operations that really, you know, some eye-popping yields back in the days when there was no yield to be found anywhere. And of course, it all sort of blew up spectacularly last year. But I can't help but wonder if that lending and borrowing market will have a rebirth, given what crypto prices are doing now. You know, we saw some new Sam Altman, the OpenAI co-founder, starting a Bitcoin private credit fund. Where is that element of the market, the lending and borrowing and yield farming? Where is all that? Are we coming back in that space as well?
Not as quickly as I think we'd like. I mean, here, Galaxy, we have a lending business. Now, we've always lent over secured and have been responsible with it. I think that what you're finding is that will come back, but you need to find the structure to allow that to come back. Because the days of, you know, I think the true Bitcoiners, not your keys, not your coin, were proven right in the aftermath of 21. And so, you know, as we look at our business and what the inbound we're getting, people are looking for leverage, and there aren't a lot of places that are equipped to give it, one, and two, have a structure in place that allows for that to happen. Prime is a true prime, or a real prime, is something that the ecosystem generally needs. We have a product that we're rolling out, G1, that hopefully addresses some of that, but it really, on a full scale, it's not there, and we're not getting there yet as a community. And so that's why I think, again, back to the ETF, why that is important is because that is an equity that fits into a system that everyone is comfortable with, and a lot of the traders and a lot of the trading desks that are in the space will just use that, and they'll do a delta replacement. They'll buy the ETF, they'll sell their Bitcoin, release cash, use the cash to buy more Bitcoin or some of these other coins that actually are that serve a purpose, right? I think that when we looked at altcoins and, you know, some of the names on that historically, people forget that that's a technology. Hey, and there's a need for that.
Hey, Jason, I got to ask you a more basic question here, and it's one that just comes down to sort of fundamentals and beliefs here. I got to get you to react to what Jamie Dimon said last week. And for those who don't know what he said, the only true use case for crypto is criminals, drug traffickers. He talked about tax avoidance, money laundering. He said, if I was the government, I'd close it down. We have a minute left. What did you make of that?
He's talking his own book. I mean, if I could look at how I would protect my brand or my ecosystem, crypto and blockchain is a disintermediating action, right? And so at the end of the day, of course he's going to say that. Dollars, physical dollars, are used more for illicit activity than crypto. It can be traced everywhere. It's immutable. The whole purpose of an immutable blockchain is that it can be tracked all the way back to its origin. So if you're a bad guy doing bad things, you're not using crypto. You're going to use other things that can't be tracked. And so I think that he's just talking his own book, quite frankly.
All right.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
It's the gift that keeps on giving, Jamie Dimon, when he talks about crypto, I have to say.
Yeah. Well, they do have their own coin, JPM.
He is
JPM,
and he's
coin
sticking to it. Jason Urban, Global Head of Trading at Galaxy Digital, the Michael Novogratz founder-led crypto firm. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Bloomberg.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Hello, live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. We're streaming on YouTube and Bloomberg Originals, Wednesday, December 13th, 2023. A happy Fed Day to everyone, and especially to Fed Chair Jay Powell, who pretty much could have done a song and dance up there. Seemed like he was pretty excited about
the direction that things are moving. We're seeing stocks higher. We're seeing yields go down. That was certainly the Fed meeting heard around the world. I'm Tim Stanovic, along with my co-host, Bloomberg News' Mike Regan, who's also now the leader of the crypto team. Mike, what did you think of that?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Tim. I mean, a lot of times when the Fed comes out with a statement that's interpreted one way by the market as sort of dovish, Powell sort of appear to intentionally talk the market out of that reaction.
Didn't see that today.
Did not see that today at all. S&P up more than 1%. All the major indexes up more than 1%. I mean, these moves after a Fed press conference oftentimes can be volatile and sort of not necessarily indicative of what to expect tomorrow and for the rest of the week. But boy, for the moment, everyone seems very happy with this statement in press conference.
Yeah, they certainly do. It's a fascinating day. And I think everyone's going to remember who pays attention to this stuff where they were, because it does seem like that the Fed has declared victory. Although it kind of, he came out and said, we haven't yet declared victory. The market's saying that they've declared victory when it comes to the war on inflation.
Right. And that Fed dot plot, so important, really telegraphing, you know, the likelihood of three rate cuts of a quarter point next year. So much closer to what the interest rate market was expecting. You know, it's off to the races in both stocks and bond markets today. Pretty remarkable move.
Well, let's see what Sarah Poncik has to say about all this. She's financial advisor at UBS Private Wealth Management. She's somebody who our audience knows well, and somebody who, Mike, you know pretty well, because she was your co-anchor of the What Goes Up podcast for so many years here at Bloomberg before she went over to UPS. Sarah, good to have you with us. How are you?
I'm great. And yeah, I was just about to say, Mike's come a really long way, head of the crypto team, since the two of us hosted a podcast together. You're doing big things, Mike.
You're going to put all your clients in crypto, I assume, this year?
Yeah, I can't discuss that due to compliance reasons.
Sarah, what do you make of what we just heard from Fed Chair Jay Powell? I mean, markets are certainly loving it.
It really is remarkable. I mean, the Fed essentially came to the table today. Powell came to the table and they patted themselves on the back, saying that, look, inflation has eased and economic growth has slowed, but, you know, it's still looking pretty good. And it's really remarkable because the Fed had every option after this last month and a half to push back against the bond market. We had seen in November the best month, the largest rally for the ag, the bond market benchmark, since 1985. And that had really undone a lot of the tightening that the Federal Reserve had done. They had even said previously, oh, well, the market's done some of our tightening work for us. So again, they had every option to push back against the bond rally, and they didn't, which is really telling the fact that, you know, the median dot next year is now showing 75 basis points of cuts. Sure, that's the median. Some expect more, some expect less. But just the fact that the Fed did not push back against the market's easing over the past month and a half is something that's big for the market, is clearly we're seeing in the rally in both bonds and stocks today.
You know, Sarah, I think one thing that has a lot of people nervous about a year like this is, at least for much of the year, it was such a top heavy rally. You know, those big famous tech stocks, whether you call them the Magnificent Seven or the Fangs, whatever the latest, whatever the kids are calling them these days, really drove the bus on this market rally this year. How are you thinking about that going forward? And what are you telling your clients? I mean, is it time to maybe diversify into everything else? Does that make sense at this point?
It does make sense, and we've seen that trade work. If you look at the month of November, for example, the equal weight version of the S&P 500, which gives every single company in the index the same weight as those Magnificent Seven, or as you said, whatever the kids are calling them these days, same exact weight, the equal weight version actually outperformed. We saw small caps outperform. We saw cyclical industries that had lagged all year long outperform. And what's interesting is if you look at the trade today, if you look at it by sector and you look at your best performers, I'm looking at it right now, your best industries are utilities up 3.6%, real estate up 3.5%, staples up 1.7%, healthcare up 1.6%. And your worst sectors are tech and communication services. So we're seeing a complete flip of what we've become accustomed to throughout this year, where the best performers are now the laggards. Yes, they're still in the green. Everything is rallying today. But we're seeing the laggards from this year really start to lead the way.
Anything make you nervous, Sarah?
There's always something that makes me nervous.
I've never seen Sarah nervous. Honest. I don't think she gets nervous.
Deep inside, Mike. Look, I mean, things are pretty good right now. One, on the bond side of the equation. And I would honestly say that one of the most difficult things for our clients over the past couple of years has been understanding that bonds can drop in value. You know, your bonds are still performing. They're still paying you income. But on paper, you're going to have losses because, you know, rates are now higher than they were when you bought those bonds. So that was really difficult. And now something to be optimistic about is bond holdings and bond performance, as you know, we really saw take off in November, and it seems like it's continuing to. And we do expect bond returns over the next year and going forwards to be pretty strong. Now, when it comes to stocks, it's interesting because when you look at the fundamentals, there are reasons to be optimistic going into next year, one being corporate earnings. When you look at 2023, corporate earnings for the S&P 500 were flat. We didn't see any growth. We didn't see any declines, but they didn't go anywhere. Now, into 2024, our chief investment office is expecting that we should see about 9% profit growth, which, you know, stocks follow earnings. So that would bode well for the market. But at the same time, when the market is now pricing in as many cuts as they're pricing in 2024, usually when the Fed starts cutting, it's not a slow grind. They start cutting pretty quickly because something's gone wrong. Now, that could bode well for the bond market, could be a rocky one for the stock market. So I'm always worried about something. But yeah, sometimes things just seem too good to be true. And even though, we're still projecting positive returns in the bond and stock market, you know, next year, it could be a rocky ride. And the fact that everyone now seems to believe in this soft landing narrative, yet the Fed's going to potentially have to cut 5 times next year, according to the market, something doesn't necessarily add up there.
Sarah, I remember a year or two ago, I feel like half of the stories that came out of markets coverage were about how 60/40 is dead. You know, bond yields are at rock bottom interest rates, stock valuations are high. You really need to rethink that. I can't help but wonder, though, now, is it 60/40? Are the kids into 60/40 these days? Is it back?
The kids are into 60/40 these days. 60/40 is back, at least for the month of November. What was it? In the month of November, it was the best month for the 60/40 portfolio since the early 90s. So that just goes to show. But much of that is predicated upon the fact that the 60/40 portfolio was claimed to be dead. And don't get me wrong, the 60/40 portfolio has gone through many tribulations over the past couple of years because interest rates were at rock bottom. You know, you really couldn't get much income from the bond market. And with the rise in bond yields and the rise in interest rates, we were going to see negative returns, a bear market in bonds when that day came, which we saw over the past couple of years. Now, you know, stock returns should continue to be pretty strong. And on the flip side of that, when you look at the 40% side, the bond side, well, if you are locking in bond yields, then you should. If you're someone still sitting in cash, you know, now's kind of the time, the flag's been waved to go ahead and lock in yields further out on the curve. Well, now you can actually get income from that 40% in bonds, and you can also potentially get capital appreciation when interest rates do come down over the next couple of years. So yes, Mike, I think the kids would say 60/40 is back, but I would also add to that, we do believe in for the majority of our clients, we typically take a portion of that 40 or 60, depending on, you know, the client's time horizon, risk tolerance, and we allocate that to private markets as well. So I wouldn't say just vanilla 60/40, but maybe spice it up and add in a little bit of alternative investments as well.
All right, Sarah Poncik, we love it when you join us. I think we'll have to do a remote down in Boca Raton, Florida, and we can all hang out there this winter. Sarah Poncik, financial advisor at UBS Private Wealth Management, joining us on Zoom from Florida.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.